Greetings, Sleepy Salsa here on this Saturday, April 23rd of 2012, and welcome to the 50th episode of the Last Best Deal podcast. This broadcast is kindly hosted over at youhavetreadonme.com and is also streamed over at truthfindersnetwork.com. I should also take this opportunity to mention that the opening theme is Ashley Alicize's A Puzzling Predicament, and the outro is Bosa's King's Quest, both of them available pursuant to Creative Commons Attribution, specifically CC BY NCSA 3.0 unported. For more information on Creative Commons, visit them at creativecommons.org. For any other content that may not be of original authorship by yours truly, any such material is used under the sincere intention of fair use. If you wish to understand the nature of the situation we are all suffering under and what can be done about it, feel free to visit the Last Bastille blog, which is located over at The Last Bastille. Bastille is spelled B-A-S-T-I-L-L-E. TheLastBastille.wordpress.com. The blog is also now available in Hypertext Transfer Protocol Secure Socket Layer, known by its more popular acronym of HTTPS. We will be taking calls all throughout this broadcast. The call-in number, courtesy of Truth Finders Network, is area code 615-713-1098. Again, that is area code 615-713-1098. The chat rooms, the primary one being located at yhtom.chatango.com, as well as the TFN chat room located at truthfindersnetwork.chatango.com, will be simultaneously be available as well. Also, it is imperative that any questions be constructive and on topic as much as possible. Believe me, although it is hard to not get off on tangents, staying on tonight's subject will be much appreciated, especially for the sake of the listening audience. If you have questions, please limit it to something we have covered or are currently discussing. As an additional courtesy, please mute your mic when we bring you in until we announce you by name. This episode, we are going to focus on firearms due to popular listener demand. Guns don't kill people. People kill each other. It is such a gross misunderstanding that the mainline public has about the invention of the firearm. People have used tools since the beginning of time. Without them, humans would have been greatly limited in what they are able to do. Guns have granted humanity the capacity to better protect life, liberty, and property from the initiation of violence. With gunpowder came the ability to reach out and touch targets from distances previously impossible. The invention of the firearm serves to both guard and expand upon the capabilities of the free market. Our guest tonight is Fox. He is a podcaster, vlogger, and gunsmith. Tonight, we're going to discuss the significance of the firearm and how it works. With that said, let us turn to our guest. Fox, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
And how are you doing tonight? Sir.
Very well. Thanks for having me on.
All right, Fox. Now, let's talk a little bit about you, and we'll then segue into the subject material. Fox, when did you first begin to see through the fog?
Well, say about 4 years ago, I was watching Meet the Fockers, and that part where Dustin Hoffman starts ripping on the CIA and Robert De Niro being the CIA agent, you know, standing up for it, saying the CIA has defended and protected many of the freedoms that Americans take advantage of today. And from that point, it kind of hit me like a freight train, you know. The CIA wiretapping us is defending our right to not be wiretapped without a warrant. That doesn't make sense. And everything just kind of fell into place.
Now, what have been your experiences in the Patriot or Liberty movement thus far?
I had a YouTube channel, and then I lost that to this whole transfer with YouTube and Google or something, and I can't log into it, so I got this new one. I'll probably stick a link in there somewhere, I don't know. I've been a member of a few different militia units, and that's where I've been spending most of my time and energy, is with that and the 3%er movement, trying to keep up with that, be part of that, and it's an honor to be a part of that.
All right, now what have been your observations on internal balkanization, which is known vernacularly as infighting?
Well, you know, it's a waste of time. I've been saying this for a few years now. We're all on the same team. It's not really hurting anybody but ourselves to be arguing over presidential candidates or abortion or any of these other things that we've gotten ourselves into. It's all political and it's all BS. And like I said, it's not hurting anybody but ourselves. You know, it's impeding our progress. We all want the same thing, and it's the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. So we're going to let something as trivial as a social issue get in the way. It seems extremely detrimental to me, but maybe I'm just crazy.
Okay. Now, what do you think can be done to improve the Patriot or Liberty movement in general, and especially in terms of recruitment and retention?
I think the biggest thing, I'm sure Randy's touched on this, people need to just put their egos aside for a minute and understand that we're all in the same movement, we're all on the same side, and we need to stand under one banner, because I tell you right now, social issues didn't get in the way during the revolution. And you see cohesive units such as the Sons of Liberty and all that. I guarantee you Captain Parker's men weren't sitting there arguing social issues on Lexington Green. So people need to, you know, that's the biggest thing, that's the biggest detriment as well as, the biggest detriment to retention is bickering and people's egos. I think a great place to start would be to put the egos aside for a minute.
Okay. All right, so let's get on to tonight's subject matter. Fox, what is the spirit of gun ownership?
Well, there's that, do you have that Thomas Jefferson quote? I should have pulled it up myself, I apologize. Should have been ready for that. I could probably paraphrase it. It brings boldness and independence to the mind, you know. It's not as much a matter of being able to procure dinner as much as it is a matter of self-defense. You look at everything in nature, the cactus, trees, wasps and bees, they all have a very basic form of self-defense. And that goes to show how basic this natural right is to self-defense. And to me, you know, that's the spirit of it, to be able to defend yourself from any criminal, whether he's wearing a suit and tie or a ski mask.
Right, exactly. And I think that's very important, is that notion of self-defense. And, you know, the founders wrote lots of really good things on several subjects. And I just think it's And I just think it's good that one of the things they wrote about was how self-defense works.
Yep, that's the only reason we won. That's the only reason. That's the only reason we threw off the crown, was because of that basic understanding and that spirit. And if you wouldn't mind, I have the quote here. If you wouldn't mind me sharing that,
please do.
This is a quote from Thomas Jefferson: "A strong body makes the mind strong. As to the species of exercises, I advise the gun. While this gives moderate exercise to the body, it gives boldness, enterprise, and independence to the mind. Games played with the ball and others of that nature are too violent for the body and stamp no character on the mind. Let your gun, therefore, be the constant companion of your walks." Now that's Thomas Jefferson, and it takes a certain person and a certain mindset to be able to own and carry a firearm, if you ask me, properly. An old friend of mine says, not every patriot is a gun owner, and not every gun owner is a patriot. There's a lot of idiots out there. It gives moderate exercise to the body, and it gives boldness, enterprise, and independence to the mind. Once you understand that as a gun owner, you are enjoying the freedom that, I don't know, two or three other countries in the world are allowed to enjoy, you become more independent yourself. And I think that's the biggest part to gun ownership, is understanding that it's a freedom that needs to be hard fought for. And has been hard fought for.
Well, yes, of course. And, you know, you can look at various other countries and various other places throughout time. And, you know, whenever the, how shall we say, whenever the right of, like, so, the, well, I guess you could say the value of self-determination is not respected, then of course you're going to have criminal types that are going to want to initiate violence against you and your family personally. And then they just do that with everybody.
Well, it's all about defense, because you're always going to have those who would prey on anybody in their way of getting what they want. Like I said before, suit and tie or a ski mask.
Oh gosh, yeah, exactly. I just right, and so Fox, I mean, as kind of a follow-up to that, I mean, do you think that the Second Amendment to the federal constitution would support that?
Absolutely. If you look at it, you know, people have twisted around well-regulated militia as being the National Guard that was created in the 1900s, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state. Well, you can look at any of the founders' writings. The militia is the people. Anybody who has a gun of fighting age is the militia. And that being necessary to the security of a free state, so needing that to be secure in your freedom, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's really simple when you put the lawyering and the BS aside.
Right, and, you know, for those of you guys who are more, and it's interesting because you are run-of-the-mill constitutionalist by definition, should be a, you know, states' rights advocate, because obviously you just have to look at the 10th Amendment. Just to use this as an example, in the Texas Constitution, under the, when specifically the Texas Bill of Rights, Section 23 says, the right to keep and bear arms, every citizen shall have the right to keep and bear arms in the lawful defense of himself or the state. And then it gets crappy from there when it says, but the legislature shall have power by law to regulate the wearing of arms with a view to prevent crime. Well, at the very least, that first half is pretty good.
Well, you know, that's states' rights. The Soviet Socialist Republic of Illinois constitution says, and I quote, "Subject only to the power of the police, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." So licensing and waiting periods and all these extra loops you have to jump through just to have one is totally and completely constitutional. If you want to talk about states' rights.
Yes, definitely hear you loud and clear on that one. And not only that, but there's also the more strictly philosophical perspective, which is known commonly as the non-aggression principle. And I did cover, and for the benefit of the listeners, I did cover that concept on a previous episode. I believe it was, strictly going from memory here, I think it was episode 45. It was the one about philosophy. But it's kind of interesting that when we're talking about the spirit of gun ownership, you know, the non-aggression principle is not the same thing as pacifism. The NAP does allow for self-defense. They're very pro-self-defense, in fact, almost ridiculously so. The only difference is that they're appealing to, I guess you could say, natural law or something like that. They're not, the NAP is not dependent on, like, the Second Amendment or Section 23 of the Texas Constitution or anything like, or anything written down. It's just like a more of a moral or ethical concept.
Well, you know, don't come to my home looking for trouble. I won't come to yours looking for trouble either.
Exactly, exactly. And just to self-correct, that was actually episode 43 on philosophy. So I got the number slightly wrong, but hey, I was close, right? But for more information on the non-aggression principle, I would suggest that listeners go back to that and listen at least to the first part of that interview, because the guest I had on for that time really covered it quite well. And I'll put a link in the TFN and YHTOM chat rooms momentarily. And then if you guys listening later on the podcast version, just go over to the blog and click on the category Last Bastille Podcast and, you know, just look for it from there. So obviously there's lots of good reasons to become a gun owner. I think that pretty much goes without saying, and I think that's what we're really getting at here.
Yep, plenty of reasons.
Okay, now let's go more into the technical nitty-gritty, I guess you could say, or at least the basics of it. Fox, what are the typical, or I guess you could say, the four basic firearm safety rules?
Well, you know, they vary in wordage or semantics from person to person, but always make sure you have proper protection. All you ladies out there, don't go to the range wearing your little shorty shorts and low-cut shirts. You're going to get a brass cut in there. Eye protection, ear protection. Second rule is keep the finger straightened off the trigger until you are on target. So a little thing that I always think of and have drilled into my own brain is the gun's always loaded and the safety's always broke. The third, you know, don't let the muzzle cover anything you're not willing to kill or destroy. You know, don't run around the house aiming the gun at your dogs. And the last is always be sure of your foreground and background. Always understand that if you're behind cover, watch where your muzzle is before you start cutting up whatever you're in front of or whatever you're behind. And always make sure of what's behind it. We don't need any issues of collateral damage. Some hero with a CCL end up stopping the shooter, but he took out a kid in the meantime. Always make sure of what's in front of you and what's behind it, what's behind the target. And like I said, those vary between whoever you ask, but they're all the same.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's interesting. Like, there's various places on the internet that seem to at least mention at least in passing about gun safety. And I will pass out these two links to both chat rooms. But for you guys listening later on the podcast version, one link is over at everycitizenasoldier.org/ID1.html. And another one is at theinternetarmory.com/safety.htm if you want to read more about firearms safety. But yeah, I think that's very important, Fox, that and this is something I've noticed too, even from people who, even if they have some experience with firearms, they tend to get careless, is that they don't. I've seen this actually happen both in gun stores and, you know, out on the range and other locations, that, you know, they'll be careless about carrying it around, and, you know, they won't be paying as much attention to where the muzzle's pointing even when it's unloaded. But I think what's really important is that it's the discipline of being cognizant of where that muzzle is pointing. It's the discipline of those various rules, and that's what really minimizes the chances of like a misfire or some other accident occurring.
Yeah, most accidents are just people being careless. That's the long and short of it.
All right, now let's go on to kind of the, I guess you could say maybe a penultimate topic, which is how do you select a firearm?
Well, I guess a very basic issue is what fits. For a lot of people I see nowadays, the six-position collapsible stock fits them best. For me personally, the fixed A2 stock fits me the best. You need to look at you need to look at what fits you and what you like and what's going to work for you. There's something people call philosophy of use. You need to understand you don't need, if you're living in a big crowded city, you don't necessarily need your first rifle or firearm to be a bolt action 308 with a ballistic scope on it. You know, you're going to need something a little more close quarters. It's there's a few things to consider, but what you ultimately need to find is something that fits you best. For some people it's an AK-47, other people it's the AR-15 M16 platform, it's other people, it's the Mini 14 or Mini 30. It's a very personal thing, and looking at forums and listening to shows like this can only do you so much. And you need to get out there, you need to handle it, and you need to figure it out for yourself. What works best for you and what works best for your environment.
Now, what would be, now as kind of a follow-up to that, what do you think would be good in terms of getting people that actually like touch guns to try them out? I mean, do you think it would be a good suggestion, for example, to have someone go to a gun range and rent a firearm just to see how it handles and just to get comfy with it without actually having to invest a few hundred dollars in something that they might not like?
Yeah, that's a great start. Is going, you know, I know a lot of ranges, you know, rent you out a handgun or rent you out a rifle or shotgun. That's a great place to do it. Great place to start. That's very, it's very static. You know, you're standing there, you're shooting at a target that's not moving. If you really want to get down and dirty and figure out what's going to work for you, go find a friend of yours who has a rifle or a handgun or shotgun that you're looking at, and take it out for a day. You know, walk around with it. You know, figure out what kind of system you will need to turn yours into. Renting one at a range is a good start, but like I said, it's very static and very predictable. And when it comes to personalization, you need to find out how it's going to work for you personally when things become unpredictable, because that's what it's, you know, that's when you're going to need it.
So maybe if somebody can, who is especially if they're starting out, maybe if they have a relative or maybe if they can find other people locally who would be comfortable with them taking them to the range or something like that and letting them handle their guns. I mean, do you think that would be better than going to a range and renting something? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, like I said, you know, renting is fine and good, but you need to understand that if you're looking for something that's going to fit you, find a way to put yourself in a situation with that firearm that is uncomfortable and unfamiliar. You know, you're not going to want to pay upwards of $500, $600, $1,200 for a rifle. Then you're going to get it, and you're going to go out. You're going to go out hunting coyotes with it, and then figure out that this is the most heavy, most uncomfortable, ridiculous rifle you ever paid for. So, renting from a range is a decent start, but if you're going to find a rifle that's personalized to you, put yourself in an uncomfortable situation with that rifle or handgun or shotgun, and you just need to see what works. And I understand most, I don't want to say most, I'm sure some people can't do that. And some people just don't know somebody with an AK-47, which is understandable, but you know, do the best that you can to understand that that's something you're going to need to take into account.
All right. Now, let's move on to probably what a lot of the guys are really interested in hearing, or at least some of them, especially the gear heads, which is, of course, the gear. Fox, what is some basic gear that, and especially for brand new shooters, what is some basic gear that people would need to have when they go shooting?
Well, you're going to need your basic cleaning kit. You know, cleaning kit, any kind of accessories that you're thinking about putting on there. If you're talking a shotgun, you know, kind of side saddle or some way of storing ammunition on the rifle, or excuse me, on the shotgun. Spare parts are going to be extremely important, especially the way things are looking now. You have to employ the weapon system, and something fails. You can't just walk down to the store, pick one up. You need to go back home, and you need to replace the bolt carrier or the firing pin. With different rifles, different handguns, there's several things that are prone to breaking. You just do your own personal research and figure out what those are. You can get titanium bolt carriers or stainless steel guide rods and these things that are virtually unbreakable, but probably will. So you're definitely going to need the spare parts in there. You know, did you want me to go into the cleaning kit now?
Sure, please do. Yes, let's definitely talk about gear for the next bit.
All right. Well, for your cleaning kit, a big thing is going to be what kind of lubrication you decide to use. If you're going to be in an extremely cold climate, for example, North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, anywhere that gets horrifically cold, I'd advise staying away from any of the gel lubricant, you know, Brake Free or Hops 9, and going with charcoal lubricant. It'll keep it from gelling up and freezing and jamming your firearm. Because remember, the loudest sound in a gunfight is click. Same thing goes with any kind of desert climate. You'll need to have both charcoal and gel. Gel seems to, if you over-applicate, if that's a word, if you use too much of it, it'll gel up, and the issues of sand and dust will become tenfold. in your firearm. You know, there's certain certain climate considerations you need to take into account when choosing lubricants, but it's always good to have both anyways. You know, your standard cleaning kit you can get at a store, you know, has the wire brush and the copper brush and the all the different things you're going to need to clean it. What I like to have in there is a lot of the run-through patches that you run down the barrel, because you can use those also to clean and lubricate parts of the bolt carrier and whatever rifle you decide to use. Also, Q-tips will become invaluable to getting into those little tight spots. With the Q-tips, though, just be careful, because some of those parts and little particles and little hairs will come off of there. So make sure you give it a good once-over, you pay good attention. Another thing I like to keep in my Smithy box is a headlamp. You know, just a little $15 LED headlamp for when lighting isn't quite sufficient enough to get in there and diagnose or see just what you need to. That little bit of light helps. But, you know, you can go to any gun store or any sporting goods store and, you know, buy a universal cleaning kit, and it'll have just about everything you'll need. But if you go with some of the, for example, Russian surplus firearms, such as the Saiga or the lower-end AK-47s, the AMD-65, the Wasser 10-63, they will need certain special things. It will vary between your firearms, but there's plenty of resources on the internet. And, yeah, pipe cleaners and rags. Thank you, Kelly. Yeah, pipe cleaner is a good thing, too. Thanks for reminding me to get into those tiny places. Now, a way to get rid of rust, before I forget, I wanted to bring this up. A copper brush and a little bit of break free or hops 9. You know, put a couple drops on the surface rust. Everybody's going to get surface rust. Put a little bit on there. Let it sit for about 5-10 minutes, depending on how bad you've let it get. And then work it out with that brush. Don't be too rough, because a copper brush will take the bluing off. You can go and get Perchwood Casey blue, steel blue, and really all you do is just apply the blue on there to anything you might have damaged or nicked. But usually if you pay decent money, if you put out a little extra, you'll have just about everything you'll need in a little cleaning kit that you can get from a store. A multi-tool is a good thing to have, too. Just as a side note, a little multi-tool you keep in there, you can get those for $5-$10. But, you know, like I said, it's real basic. You don't need to go all out and spend hundreds of dollars. It's pretty simple stuff. You know, Q-tips, paper towels, and a $60 kit. And you should be fine. That, and then spare parts that are prone to breakage. You know, people will argue with the Glock, for example, the polymer guide rod is prone to breaking. Well, I've never seen that happen. I think there's 2 or 3 stories on the internet, and I'm sure 1 or 2 of them are lying. So if you want the added weight if you want to modify your handgun in any way to, you know, keep the muzzle down, or you want that security, then sure, put a steel guide rod in there. But your basics for the AR-15, bolt carrier, firing pin, any of the extra, the cam pin, any of the fire pin, retaining pin, all those little bitty parts in there, at some point are going to wear down or they're going to break. So make sure at the very least you have a spare bolt carrier and a spare firing pin at the minimum.
Okay, well, let's also look at the other types of gear. Now, so something I kind of wanted to get clarification on, because in the, I guess you could say the firearm ownership community, or what passes for it, there's, in terms of semantic problems, or I guess you could maybe say verbicide, the distinction between mags and clips. Fox, what is a mag and what is a clip?
A magazine is a box that you stick into the mag well, and it feeds ammunition into the receiver. A clip is what the rounds are stored in. It's a little piece of metal with two lips on the side, and it keeps them in there. That's it. I'm going to go off on a tangent here. I hope you don't mind too much. In the Black Hawk Down situation in Mogadishu, all of the Rangers decided to do speed reloads and drop their magazines just on the ground. Anybody could come pick them up, whatever. They got resupplies dropped into them. Excuse me. They got resupplied and dropped into them. All of the ammo was stored in clips, not magazines. They were dropping their magazines and didn't have them. It's really hard to explain without showing somebody a picture. But a clip and a magazine are completely different, and I personally want to strangle somebody every time I hear it. Especially in the movies, you know?
Oh, well, yeah, because, I mean, you consider the predictive programming elements, and a lot of times they'll just get stuff wrong. I mean, I can't tell how many times, you know, I've been talking to one of my, veteran buddies, and they're saying, hey, by the way, did you notice in XYZ movie how this particular unit moved? They completely sucked. Here's what they should have been doing, XYZ. So now what were clips exactly?
Oh, a clip is something you can use to reload the magazine. It's very simple. It's a piece of steel, and all it does is hold 10 to 15 rounds of ammo, depending on, you know, an SKS stripper clip will hold 10. Some of the 5.56 stripper clips, you'll find 15, 20, whatever. All it is a piece of metal that the bullets are held onto. The magazine is what you stick in the gun.
Okay, so I guess what you're saying is that a clip is not a mag, correct? Am I hearing you accurately?
That's very correct.
Okay. Because I also noticed that various other people were getting upset whenever they would refer to a magazine as a clip. So is that some sort of faux pas, or what exactly is going on there, Fox?
I have no idea. It's in the movies, you hear some. I heard it on a TV show today. Give me another clip.
I don't agree with that. I've always been under the assumption, okay, a magazine is anything that sticks outside of the firearm that you're firing. So if your gun is meant like for a handgun, it holds 9 rounds. That is a clip. Anything that goes beyond that 9 round and portrays from the actual firearm itself that is not natural form, like a AR-15 has a 15 magazine clip that goes in the bottom. It doesn't blend. That is a magazine. Anything that, if it's less or fits into the firearm, is a clip. So I don't understand where you're saying that at all.
Okay. Go to Google and search for images of stripper clip. And then search for magazine. Those are the differences.
Stripper clip. All right, let me see, because okay, but that is a clip that holds on the back, but you have a same thing, and I see what you're saying, but that is not the only type of clip. So you can't say that that's the only type of clip, because in a handgun, that clip that goes in there is a clip. You don't hold your clips like on like your 223 ammo. If you're holding a 9mm or 45 or anything caliber, those aren't held on a clip. They're held in what goes in the gun, which is a clip. So there's two different things, and they're both separate. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, a magazine is a box magazine that you stick into the handgun or rifle or shotgun.
Okay, so I load my ammo into... So you're saying my 45 cal I've got is not a clip that I'm loading my rounds into and sticking in my gun. It's a magazine.
That is a magazine.
Okay.
And Fox, just to clarify, what is it accurate to say that the whole point of the invention of the stripper clip was as a way of trying to reload faster? So instead of loading rounds, and for the listeners, a bullet is a round. That instead of having to load rounds into the magazine one by one, you would instead have the bullets put on a stripper clip and then, or various stripper clips, and then if you need to reload, you just put one of those inside a magazine. Is that accurate to say?
You could do it with magazines now. When it was invented, it came up with the various bolt action rifles, and then you saw it with semi-automatic rifles like the M1 Garand. You just pop it in, and that's it. None of the rounds are encased. That's a stripper clip. With the SKS, you stick the stripper clip into a little guide on the receiver, and you push the bullets down off the clip. It was made as a way of reloading quicker instead of sitting there popping in one round at a time. You know, you're right. That's it. Nowadays, you see them coming. The 5.56 is stored in stripper clips in the cases that get sent out wherever. But you can load magazines from those. But it was created as a way to load 10 rounds into your rifle a lot quicker than pulling one or two out at a time and using your thumb and sticking them in there.
Okay, that I believe that does make sense. And I would like to thank Kelly for coming on and for her questions and comments. Obviously, Kelly is the workhorse behind Truth Finders Network, so you know she's cool and stuff. All right, now Fox, continuing on. Now, what about is there any sort of safety equipment that would be needed as well, especially for new shooters?
Just eye and ear protection. Other than that, you know, you're not going to really need any other safety equipment. That's pretty much it. I'm not sure.
Okay. Now, what about, paper targets or more stuff to shoot at or any other equipment that would be needed to set up targets? How does that all hang together?
Well, just, get some I guess if you're shooting at longer ranges, they have high visibility targets where you can see where you're grouping and where you're shooting, which are nice. Or if you're going to a static range, just get a silhouette or some little circles or something. I personally, I like zombie targets.
Yeah, Scott, I definitely practiced for those. It was mentioned on Gorillas in the Mist.
Super Ninja Robot Zombie Nazis.
Okay, say that one more time for the listeners, please.
Super Ninja Robot Zombie Nazis.
Yeah, got to prepare for those guys because they those proverbial folks can wreak havoc at any time, so got to be prepared and whatnot. I didn't even know they made zombie targets. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it just makes it a little more fun going to the range for the day for a couple hours.
Oh yeah, my son's wall is posted with a zombie chick. He shoots the zombie chick every chance he gets. I think he's honestly just signing up for the boobs, but he shoots her up anyways. Then posts them on his wall.
You know, in one sense that sounds cool, in another sense it sounds slightly disturbing. But I understand. That's pretty funny.
It is very disturbing because these targets actually have them like zombies, and there's like blood coming off of them. And some of them, like if you actually shoot them, they have like the Halloween blood that splatters out of them. So just depending on how much you want to spend on the targets. But he's shot them all, and he loves shooting zombies.
Right.
Go figure.
Right, and I would like to remind the listeners that we are taking calls at this time. The call-in line is area code 615-713-1098. That is area code 615-713-1098. And one more time, in case you didn't get it the first two times, area code 615-713-1098. You can also join us on Skype if you add on username. I believe it's Truthfinders. And also
Truthfinders Network.
Truthfinders Network. Thank you, Kelly. And you can also just ask your questions in either one of the two chat rooms, either the one for YHTOM or TFN, and do it that way. So you got three methods, guys, this go around for asking questions. Now, continuing on, Fox, while we wait for people to chime in with questions and comments. What about, now obviously if you're going to go to the range, you're going to go practice your marksmanship. I mean, if you're going to be bringing a bunch of stuff, the safety gear, targets, the firearm itself, bullets, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Wouldn't that have to go into a bag of some kind? And if so, what should a range bag contain in terms of gear?
Well, you can get some pretty cool range bags that'll fit one rifle, two rifles. They got pouches all over the place, Molly attachments. All you really need is a bag that's big enough for the rifle, shotgun, or handgun, with enough room for a couple boxes of ammo, however much ammo you decide, a couple spare parts, and some of the basics from your cleaning kit or your entire kit, whatever. What I like to do is have extra oil, a few spare parts just in case, my patches and Q-tips and paper towels, multi-tool and any screwdrivers, my shotgun has a side saddle on there, so I bring the screwdrivers that I would need to take it off or put it back on or repair it, whatever. You know, when you take your firearm to the range, look at it and think about everything that could go wrong, however unlikely. And what my grandpa always told me was, if you have to ask whether or not to bring it, the answer is yes.
Okay.
So, you know, just your very basics, unless you want to get a big bag and bring everything, bring your basics from your cleaning kit. You know, you don't really need that much. You see people coming into the gun range with a big old bag with a bunch of pouches on it, and then they got a big old backpack and they got all this stuff with them. You don't really need all that stuff. It just becomes cumbersome. And you don't want to drag it around and you're probably going to forget something. So just your basics.
Right, okay. And for one example of one individual's range bag, I'll put it in the both chat rooms momentarily. If you guys listening later on the podcast version, it's a Kirihi's site over at everycitizenasoldier.org/ID45.html. But just very quickly, some things he'll have in his... It's something he likes to call his second line gear. And I did cover the notion of the line concept of gear with the previous podcast episode on survivalism, which was, I believe it was the last one. It should have been episode 49. So for more information on that, visit that podcast for the line concept of gear. And I'll put a link to that, too, in the chat rooms momentarily. But, you know, his second line gear also doubles as his range bag. And some of the things he had in it would be like a pistol belt or like a clean kit and spare parts, like you just mentioned. Interestingly enough, he had a shotgun bandolier, which I thought was interesting. An MRE in case, and he explains that in case he has to train through lunch or he has to go to the woods or whatever the case is. And also, I thought this was interesting, a larger blowout kit with like Izzy dressings, triangular bandage, tourniquet, gloves, and some C-locks. And I thought that was kind of interesting. So, Fox, do you think it's a good idea to have some sort of like medical kit inside a range bag?
Yeah, it's a good idea. But the surgical kits and medical kits can get pretty expensive, just like Quick Clot. Any range that you go to, unless it's out on some forest preserve and there's no lifeguard on duty, basically, they'll have a very extensive blowout kit. I guarantee it. Everywhere has. So, gun clubs as well, if you're into shooting traps, skeet and sporting clays, guaranteed. They have all kinds of medical supplies to hold you over till paramedics get there. But I'm not saying you don't need it, because it's always good, you decided to holster a loaded weapon and you shot yourself in the thigh. Not too bad of an idea to have some Quick Clot on you. Not too bad of an idea to have pressure gauze on you. So, yeah, that's a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. But like I said, rest assured, if you don't have some, don't let it freak you out, because I bet you that gun shop has some, or the range or wherever you decide to go has some there.
All right, now let's kind of move away from gear, and let's look at general maintenance. So, Fox, what do especially new shooters, what do the newer guys need to know about field stripping and maintenance of firearms?
You need to, first of all, know, understand, and dominate your weapons. If you can't take it down and put it together without, I'm not going to say blindfolded, I'm not going to say in 10 seconds or less, if you can't take it down and put it together without stopping to think about what goes where, you need to work on it. You need to understand and dominate your weapon system. So that you can better diagnose or you can better utilize that weapon. I apologize. What were the other parts of the question? I got a million things in my brain right now.
No, I think you more or less answered it at least in a good way. But basically, like, how does field stripping work? Like, what does somebody need to know in terms of just doing basic maintenance?
Know the basic points in which to keep oiled regularly, what not to oil, what not to take apart, unless you're qualified. The AR-15 has several places. The AK-47 has its own places. Shotguns have places. You need to do your research on that once you found one and understand the points on the bolt or the carrier or whatever that will wear most, that will cause damage and eventually break if not attended to. And too much oil will seep through to your receiver and take the bluing off, and extremely it will damage your firearm. So don't be too conservative. Don't be liberal. Be just right. You know, leave it to where it is a nice glisten. It's not drooping with oil, but there's a nice smooth glisten to it. Because like I said, if you over oil it, you're going to damage the firearm.
Okay. Now, let's move on to zeroing. Fox, how does zeroing work? What are the basics of zeroing?
Start from either the Indian style, however you want to call it. People have their own words for it. Indian style or prone. Very stable and secure. And understand the basics. You know, slow squeeze to the rear on the trigger, breathe in, breathe out, and start at 25 meters. And make your adjustments from there so that you're shooting three rounds at a time. You're putting them within an inch of each other. And then move yourself back to either 100 or 200 yards, whatever kind of zero that you want, and make those adjustments accordingly. You know, if you're living in a city, you don't want a 250-yard zero. If you're living out in the country, you're going to want more than a 75-yard zero. It all depends the yardage of your zero on where you live and where you think you'll end up using your firearm in a defense situation. Or hunting, or whatever the philosophy of use is for the firearm itself.
Right, because firearms are a multi-use tool. Exactly. All right, well, let's now take a look at shooting positions. So, Fox, what are the basic shooting positions?
Three basics are standing, kneeling, and prone. And your prone is going to be your most stable. You're kneeling. A lot of mistakes that I see people make is putting their elbow bone on their knee bone. So you've got bone to bone right there. Now, if the listeners feel so inclined, I'm sure we're all sitting down tonight, stick your elbow on your knee. And just move your hand a little bit and understand how unstable that is. Now, there's a big strap of cartilage right above your elbow. Put that on your knee and then move it around a little bit. And you'll see how much more stable that is than sticking bone to bone. That's a big mistake that people make. And if you're zeroing, your zero is going to be off, and your adjustments are going to, they're going to be for naught. It's going to be a whole waste of your time and a waste of your ammo. And right now, ammo is not cheap. If you're going to zero, or you're going to make the precision shot, make sure you're doing it right. There's also other ones. My grandpa taught me one that was used a lot in Vietnam, which was crouching. I can't remember what he called it, but you're basically crouching down, and your ass is on the back of your feet. Excuse my French, I try not to swear. Your knees aren't on the ground or anything. You're just crouched down. That's it. There's the Indian style, which you see a lot in the military when they're working on their marksmanship, is you're sitting Indian style with the elbow, cartilage, whatever you want to call it, on the knees. And that's very stable as well. And then standing, which is the most unstable of those. But like I said, if you're zeroing, you need to be as stable as possible, whether that's on a whether that's on the on a table at the range or behind one of the little bean bags that you can use, laying prone, the best you can to be as stable as possible. When you're putting your zero in, it's very important that you do that.
Right, and I think the rule of it's always muscle to bone, never bone to bone.
Exactly.
And yeah, it will. And if you follow the muscle to bone rule, you should be more stable with whatever position you're in. And I did put this in both chat rooms on shooting positions. And for you guys listening later on the podcast version, go over to everycitizenasoldier.org/ID16.html, which is Kirihi's page on shooting positions. And this is funny because this is actually much more involved. In fact, a simpler version, and I put this in both chat rooms as well, and for you guys in the podcast version later, if you go over to YouTube and type in rifle marksmanship with the M1 rifle, it's also known as M1 marksman. I think it's like M1 marksmanship or something. But rifle marksmanship with the M1 rifle. It was made in 1942. There's approximately like an hour long-ish video that was made during World War II. Where they had four basic shooting positions. It was standing, kneeling, it was called like crouching or sitting or something like that, and then prone. And obviously with standing, they do, at that time, they told everybody to do like the chicken wing thing with their support arm. Although Fox, when you're standing, now, what's the deal with that? Because I've been noticing different people saying different things. You know, some people say the same thing like they did during World War II, where if you're doing the standing position, you should have the your arm at basically a 45-degree angle, basically parallel to the ground, again, known as like the chicken wing thing. But then other people say, no, you need to keep that elbow tucked in. So, Fox, what's your perspective on that?
Well, if you want to get it shot off, go ahead and stick your elbow out there. If you intend on keeping your elbow, tuck it into the side so it's straight up and down parallel with your body. It makes little to no difference in your marksmanship whether or not you stick your elbow out there.
Now, that's interesting because on the shooting positions page on Kirihi's site, he actually shows pictures under standing positions. There's something he calls the traditional offhand position, which I have to admit looks a lot like what's in that World War II M1 marksmanship training video. But then he shows both something called the modified offhand position as well as something called the UFP, which is the universal fighting position. And this it's not the supporting arm, it's the firing arm that sticks out like a chicken wing. My bad, sorry about that, guys. The firing arm is the one that sticks out like a chicken wing if you're going to do it the World War II style. But again, in modified offhand position and UFP, universal fighting position, the firing armed elbow is tucked in. So, I mean, you can literally see the difference between the two. And it's interesting you should mention, Fox, about if you want your if you want to do the chicken wing, just don't be surprised if it's shot off.
Yeah. Now, I got a question here from Tennessee Rose, if you don't mind me addressing
that. Oh, please do. We're taking questions and comments this entire time, so please do.
What about facing front, feet apart, as opposed to feet side to side? What you want to do, anybody who's played any sports, shoulder width apart, but put your off foot or your response foot or your weak foot just a little bit forward. So for me, my feet are shoulder width apart, and my left foot is forward just a little bit. That gives you a little bit more stabilization, and you'll notice it too.
Don't lock your legs.
Bend at the knees like a sports thing. definitely don't lock out, because that'll wreak havoc in your shoulder, and your knees will be sore tomorrow.
Right, and I'm glad you took that question, Fox, from TN Rose. And one thing I would like to add on to that I'm noticing from this web from Kirihi's site is that in terms of the foot positioning between modified offhand position and UFP, is that in modified offhand, the feet, again, the left foot, I think, is a little bit forward, but then with UFP, from what I'm seeing, they're directly lined up. So, again, I mean, these are just different positions just with standing alone. So you have those basic positions, but then, as you can see, just with standing, there are some noticeable variations depending on where the elbow is, depending how your feet are, and that sort of thing.
Well, this is another thing that's slightly personal as well. There's people who can outshoot people with their feet with one foot way back behind the other one, or one foot forward. You know, they have their own stances. You know, I'm just giving you my best informed opinion on this. Is it shoulder width apart, your off foot forward a little bit, bending your knees, very sporting, and leaning forward a little bit. You'll see these girls who get out there and they're anticipating the recoil so much that they're leaning all the way back. You want to lean forward, and you want to bring the cheek rest or cheek weld or whatever to your chin. Don't bring your head down. You want to be straight up and down. You don't want to be straight up and down to your shoulders and then your head cocked over to the side. You know, tuck it in as tight as you can with that hand, your weapon hand, and bring that gun up to your shoulder. Bring it up to your cheek. Don't cock your head to the side and stay straight up and down as best you can. It's kind of hard to explain it without showing anybody.
Right, exactly. Well, we do what we can with this particular communications medium where it's just purely verbal. Now, moving on to sitting, again, on the same exact page by Kirihi, I'm noticing that even with sitting, there's two variations he's showing. There's the first version, which is the same one on the M1 Marksmanship World War II video, where you're sitting on your butt, and again, keeping to that principle of always muscle to bone, your legs are kind of splayed out a little bit, and then you basically rest your biceps on top of your kneecaps, and you otherwise have the same position, at least for the like shoulders and all that you would for prone, or at least pretty close to it. But then what's interesting is that there's this other version that he's showing where you sit like cross your legs like Indian style, and you're leaning really, really, really far forward so that at least a little bit of your muscle that is behind your elbow is kind of a little bit close to the knee. And I'm looking at doesn't really stick to the muscle to bone principle. It actually looks bone on bone with elbow directly on the side of the kneecap. So I don't know if that Indian style sticks as well. I mean, that World War II version where you're sitting on your butt and you're splaying your legs a little bit more, because you can obviously see that it's sticking to muscle to bone.
Well, a couple things. You know, I'm not trying to you know, be a jerk to you or anything, but you're looking at World War II stuff. You know, there's a big difference between the M1 Garand and carbine versus an M16. You know, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but, you know, things do change with time. And like I said before, it's very personal to the person, which position works best for you. Another thing, you don't want to muscle your way to reducing recoil. Why you see them leaning forward so much is you want to put as much body mass behind the rifle. If you go with a 5.56 or AR-15 or Mini-14, you're not going to have very much recoil. That's why you see him leaning forward so much, because he's got a M1, I'm guessing, with a 30-06 round. But the more mass that you can put behind your rifle or shotgun, the less recoil you'll have, the easier it'll be for follow-up shots. And the more you try to muscle your way to reducing recoil, you're going to pull your shots down and you're going to miss. That's why you need to understand that your offhand, if you're a right-handed shooter, your left hand is your offhand. And your offhand is what stabilizes the rifle. Your right hand, you should be able to drop it and still have everything on target. Your right hand is just there to pull a trigger.
Okay.
If you muscle your way, you're going to pull your shots and you're going to miss.
Okay. And, of course, the other major shooting position is prone, where you're literally laying on your stomach and kind of spraying your legs out behind you, and you're just trying to lay down as flat as possible. And now, Fox, would it be accurate to say that prone is the most stable shooting position?
Yeah. You know, you have one thing to remember about prone is put your feet out as far back as possible and make your heels touch the ground as best you can. I can't all the way because my knees are horrific, but as best you can, flatten everything out about your body, because your recoil will come all the way back. And if your feet aren't set, it will ruin your accuracy. And it doesn't seem like much, but that recoil will go all the way through your entire body. And if your feet aren't set properly, it will affect your groups. So put your heels down on the ground as best you can. And that's and just be straight and get as much body mass as possible behind the rifle to stop that recoil. Don't muscle your way through reducing recoil.
Right. Now, the basic shooting positions of standing, kneeling, sitting, and prone, assuming those are the four basic ones, obviously, we've been discussing it more in the context of long guns, but also it would work with handguns. Handguns being defined as a gun you can hold in one hand, like a pistol or a revolver, and long guns being defined as something you need two hands for, such as a shotgun or rifle. Now, when you are dealing with handguns, there are some additional considerations in terms of actually holding it. Again, what I'm seeing here on this one page is like isosceles versus Weaver and modified Weaver. So, Fox, what do you think is the best way for actually holding a handgun?
Especially with 40, 45, 44, any of the heavier loads, the same goes with putting mass behind the handgun to reduce recoil, especially with heavy loads. And here's another one. A lot of people are going to pull the trigger and pull the gun down so that they reduce the recoil. You're going to pull your shots. You're going to be out. You're going to be out of your center or wherever you're shooting at. You're going to be shooting low. And then you're going to think that it's part of the handgun's issue, so you're going to start holding over. I personally prefer what Magpul preaches, where you're squared up just like you would with a rifle, and your hands... I'm doing it right now, by the way, for all the listeners at home, so I can try and tell everybody. Your arms are straight out. Let's see. And your shoulders are brought up to your ears so that you're not cocking your head down or anything. You got to bring the sights up to your face. Not to your face. Up into your eyesight. I personally don't like the Weaver stance or isosceles. It's borderline isosceles, what I'm talking about. I don't like the Weaver because your movement, if you're shooting and moving, your movement will bounce your handgun up and down or left and right. It's not very stable. And there's millions of ways to hold the gun. You just need to figure out what works best for you. And like I said, if you have a higher caliber load, then you're going to need to consider the recoil and the ability to make follow-up shots. And putting your hands as high up as you can without getting chopped up or anything by the slide is going to take that down a lot. And putting as much of your shoulders behind it and as much mass behind the handgun as possible is going to reduce your recoil greatly and give you a better ability to make those follow-up shots.
Okay, good. Now, before we move on to what I want to ask you next, I did want to read a comment that was made a little bit ago by Evenhand, and it was in regards to what we were mentioning earlier in terms of safety. And what he said was, when I was in the seventh grade, my first time good hunting, I think he meant the first time he had good hunting trip, I had a double-barreled shotgun in 12-gauge. Me and my friend, who was half Indian, walked around a lake trying to get close to a field. He went through a barbed wire fence, and then it was my turn. I used the gun to push the barbed wire down, and as I went through, and bam, it went off. No trigger was pulled. It was only by sheer circumstance. It was not pointed right at my friend's back. It was pointed at the ground, just a few degrees up, and it would have hit him in the back. He just turned around with a quick look over his shoulder, and to this day does not know how close things were. It scares the shit out of me just to think of it. Fate is so fickle, since I had no control except being a stupid kid on my first trip out. Now I never put my barrel anywhere near people today. I am hypersensitive about where my barrel is pointed. I figured I have used my one grace. Wow, that's pretty powerful, at least in terms of really kind of learning from the mistakes of one's youth, I guess.
Well, you know, it's sometimes it happens, you know, I guess, you know, I can't explain why it went off without the trigger. Maybe there is a hammer, external hammer to it or something. I don't know what happened, but it just, you need to drill into your brain before you go anywhere that there's a red hot laser beam shooting out of that barrel and you don't want to cut anybody down with it. So, I mean, just muzzle discipline at all times. The safety's always broken. It's always loaded.
Right, of course. Now, what drills can be done, especially those at home, in terms of practicing good gun handling skills, marksmanship, that sort of thing?
With any firearm, regardless if it's a revolver, an automatic pistol, or a rifle, shotgun, anything can be done at home as far as mag changes. If you want to be super safe about it, go out and get a pack of snap caps, which are basically dummy plastic rounds. You know, you could practice tactical reloads, in which with the tactical reload, there's a lull in the firefight, and you have a chance to reload because you're down to five or six rounds. You want to get a fresh magazine in there. You can work on especially what a lot of people should be doing is working on drawing from the holster. And with this one, I would definitely recommend extreme safety and extreme attention to what you're doing. A lot of accidents happen from the holster, which is why most any range you'll see signs, no drawing from the holster. Put a little post-it note on your wall, and every morning, every evening, anytime you get the chance, practice drawing from the holster and getting it on target onto that little post-it, or do it however long you want. But those are little drills, mag changes and drawing from the holster. Another one you could do from Patrol Ready, which is having the it's hard to explain now. Having the firearm up, but not aimed at anything. It's just kind of down and in front of you. Is the Patrol Ready what you see in the, walking around on combat patrol, not aiming at anything. It's just down. You're holding it in front of you. Just work on safety manipulation. With the AR or the AK, you can work the safety with one hand. The AR especially. You can start at patrol ready with the safety on and bring the rifle up to bear on the post-it and flip that safety off. And then bring it down, flip that safety on, and then bring it back down. You can do the same with handguns. A lot of people are fans of the Glock. Doesn't have a manual safety, has a trigger safety. The XDs, just the trigger safety. 1911s have the thumb safety. Beretta, Smith & Wesson's. Work on that safety manipulation and practice. Bring it up to that post-it, click that safety on, and drop it back in the holster. Because when you need to use the firearm, all of your alarm reaction and responses will be gross motor skills. These little bitty tiny safeties and very fine motor skills that are required will become useless if it's not second nature to you. When you're stressed and you're in that situation, holy goodness, somebody's coming into my house. Your adrenaline's going. Your alarm reaction is going to be a hindrance if you haven't practiced the safety manipulation.
Yeah, and Fox, wasn't there also that phrase that's used commonly in firearms instruction schools? And I might be butchering it a little bit, but I think it went something like this, where you never rise to the occasion, you sink to the level of your training.
Yeah, I haven't heard that, but that makes sense.
Well, I mean that sounds like an encapsulation of what you were talking about, because when the Super Ninja Robot zombie Nazis come barreling through the front door or windows or wherever the entry points are in whatever locale you're in, you're going to be – I mean, anyone would be scared and kind of freaked out that an emergency is happening.
Yeah. Now, another thing with the alarm response is train keeping both your eyes open. even with a handgun, especially with a shotgun and rifle. Because when you're stressed, somebody's coming in the door, or you're a CCL holder, you need to drop somebody, you are not going to be closing one eye and taking that second to breathe in and breathe out and then slowly squeeze the trigger. All of that stuff goes out the door. Your eyes are going to be bugged out. You're going to be breathing. Your heart rate's going to be 120 beats a minute. You're going to be freaked out. And the biggest thing is if you don't practice with both your eyes open, you aren't going to close one eye when you're stressed. You need to do a lot of stress testing and stress training of yourself, and understand that train now while it's ideal circumstances, because when it's not, you're going to need that training. Now, something I came up with last year, whenever I just had this realization one day, that when I walk somewhere, I've been doing it for 24 years, whatever. And when you walk, you don't think about it. You just get up and you walk to the kitchen, or you get up and you walk to the store. You don't think, you don't mentally think, okay, left foot, okay, now move your right foot. Okay, now pick up your left leg and move it forward. You just do it. And you need to be able to train to the point of which everything is subconscious and everything is reaction. Just instantaneous reaction. Because you're not going to have time to sit there and think about what you need to do when you need to do it.
Wow, very powerful advice. Really is good to kind of emphasize kind of that stress reaction training. Now, there's also been some activity in one of the chat rooms, and there was a question about, now, what about double-action handguns without safeties? How do you keep them from misfiring? For example, like the Smith & Wesson 4586, it's a sweet gun but has no safety.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, now, forgive me, I am... With most revolvers, there is a place in which you can keep the hammer. There's three positions: forward, half-cocked, and far back when you're ready to fire. If you keep it half-cocked, that should be as good a safety as any. But you need to roll the dice if you decide to get a revolver, because you're looking at six, maybe seven shots. Revolvers are sweet guns. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say it's not. But, that's something you need to understand, that revolvers really don't have a safety. But if you get double action, pulling that trigger is going to bring the hammer back. If you get a single action, that's safety enough if you keep the hammer forward. But that's a roll of the dice. I'm not a big fan of wheel guns myself, but that's just something you're going to have to think about.
Okay. That was my question I was trying to say in the chat room. It's not a revolver. It's a pistol. So I don't know, maybe you're confused because it's Smith & Wesson, but it's what the police force used to use before they switched over to the 9/11. It's a double-action pistol. Not any revolver. It holds the chamber, but you have to pull back the bolt to load it. But there is no safety mechanism on it. I love the gun. Okay, but
what model is it?
It's a 4586. But the problem is it does not have a so-called safety gun. And I owned one of these, and I got rid of it because every time I holstered it. And I can show you a picture of one if you're looking for one or whatever. But it's not a revolver at all.
I don't think... Yeah, if you wouldn't mind sending me a picture, I'm not sure...
Absolutely. I'll put it in there.
All right. Well, let's continue on then, and let's get more into the very important subject matter of actually buying firearms. And I put this link in the chat room on Survival Gun Selection, which is courtesy of survivalblog.com. Very, very good overall website. I definitely mentioned it in the previous podcast episode, episode 49 on survivalism. And there's some very good things there. For this particular episode, I wanted to bring up what James Wesley Rawls's survival gun recommendations were. And what he said was, in regards to like a basic battery, especially if you're on a budget, he recommended four firearms. The first one is, as he said, a good quality bolt action rifle chambered in 308 or 30-06. The second one is a 12-gauge pump shotgun with a spare Riot gun barrel. The third is a 22 LR rifle. And the fourth is a 45 automatic pistol. So, Fox, do you think that recommendation for a basic battery, and especially for a new shooter, do you think that is a good recommendation?
Basic budget for the survivalist. Even if you're on a budget, 30-06 and 308 can get pricey. My recommendation, especially if you're on a budget, is the good old Mosin Nagants. You can find for $100 at your gun store, if you can find them. They're actually flying off the shelves. But the 7.62x54R ammunition is quite cheap and affordable. And that's just as big, just as strong as a 308. Now, as far as the shotgun, the Riot barrel is a good idea to have, absolutely. The other barrel should be one that you can use to procure game, bird hunting, a rabbit, small game like that, same as the 22. And 45, I'm very partial to 45, love it. They say the 9 mils always expand, but 45 never gets smaller. The only thing is, if somebody's on a budget, 45 is way more expensive right now. And 9 mil will put a hole in somebody just the same as 45 will. Smaller hole, but it's cheaper. And you just can't beat the 45. It packs one hell of a punch. But that's survivalist. And I'm kind of surprised that he didn't include a patrol rifle or a carbine, M4, AR-15, M1, SOCOM, whatever. Some kind of patrol rifle is going to be pretty important. A bolt action gun will only get you so much. Big game and somebody far out, but...
Right, and for those of you guys listening later on the podcast version, if you want to read James Wesley Rawls's Survival Gun Selection article, it is located over at survivalblog.com/survivalguns.html. And kind of doing a sort of follow-up on that, I was looking at, I know it's a year old, but, bear with me, guys. The 2011 Gun Buyer's Annual, Issue 97, I believe it was, and I was kind of bookmarking some stuff that I thought might be interesting, and I wanted your take on these, Fox. So, for example, for somebody who would prefer a pistol, what I was noticing was, and I know you like the 45 for a hole and all that, but, I actually... having actually tried a 45, I couldn't hit anything worth a damn, but if it's in a 9mm, I can actually hit stuff with it. Now, maybe that's user error on my end with not being able to control recoil, like how one of my veteran buddies did suggest that that is a strong possibility. I mean, do you think that's accurate, that anybody who can't control a 40 or especially a 45 and hit stuff is not controlling the recoil accurately, especially if they can use a 9mm?
You know, it could be it. I wasn't there. I have no idea what happened, what you were doing. It's just another one of those personal things. If you can't hit anything with a 45, but your light's out with a 9mm, stick with 9mm.
Okay. Well, like what I was noticing was, for a pistol, was the Glock 19, which is a 9mm, pistol, and its going rate, at the time of this publishing was ranged at between $600 to like about $670. So it's a bit pricey in one regard, but supposedly with Glocks, you can, I remember there was this one torture testing thing that somebody did where they like ran over a Glock pistol from like different directions with an SUV and then parked on top of it for an hour and then shot 100 rounds through it with no malfunctions. Another torture test was like dumping it in water and doing the same thing and putting it in mud. And also the chemical degreaser test was probably one of the more interesting ones. And basically through these torture tests, there were no malfunctions. So supposedly Glocks are a very, very good pistol brand. Would you concur on that one, Fox?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You could shoot a Glock and it would still dump a mag. Glocks are extremely reliable.
Okay. Now,
that's all right. The going rate for a full sized bare bones Glock is about $550. Yeah, that's a lot of money, but you know, compared to a SIG with comparable value, that's a good price, and you can get them factory refurbished for. Take off about $75 off of that, so you're looking, $475 to $550 for a full sized Glock. That's a great price for what you're getting.
Okay. Now, for those of the guys who would prefer revolvers or would want a revolver in addition to a pistol, something I was looking at. I mean, I'm not too big on wheel guns. But if I were to do something like that, I mean, what looked really attractive was, of course, a snub nose, which, for the listeners, a snub nose is where the barrel length, I believe, is 1 inch. And just looking randomly at stuff, I found this one thing, which was the EAA Windicator, which is available in 38 special, and the going price at time of publication was a range of approximately $300 to $325, and it was a 6-shot capacity.
Well, that's just another personal thing for wheel guns. For me, it's hard finding a carry caliber, 38 special, 357, any of these, anything smaller than a 500 Smith & Wesson revolver doesn't fit my hands.
Mm.
It's all personal, and you need to take into account that if you need to employ it in a carry situation or self-defense or whatever, you only got 6 shots, and you only got 6, and then you need to reload.
And unless you're going to be carrying speed loaders with you or something, which in a normal, if the scenario is you're doing something like a CHL, I don't think anybody's going to be carrying like 2 or 3 speed loaders with rounds in it in addition to their wheel gun. I think what would be much more likely, correct me if you disagree with this, I think what would be much more likely would be somebody carrying a pistol with at most 2 spare mags on them.
Well, if you're taking the obligation of carry seriously, you need to carry extra ammunition because you don't know what you're going to run into the second you walk out that house. You don't know what's going to happen. And if you're going to go out there with 6 rounds and people are going to depend on you for their lives, then I think you're not taking it seriously if that's all you're taking. So if you decide to take a wheel gun, you need to understand that you got five to seven round capacities with wheel guns, revolvers. You need to understand that.
Okay. Now that's interesting you should say that. Now, obviously, on the the previous podcast episode on survivalism, when me and my guests were mentioning about the line concept of gear, the first line of gear is basically the equivalent of you're basically an EDC or everyday carry, which more or less would be the same kinds of stuff you would carry if you've got like a CHL. Or even where, depending on where you live and depending on your own carry philosophy, which of course we can also get into that if you want to. But also, if you prefer to do open carry as well. And it was interesting, you know, some of the guys go back and forth about, well, you know, if I'm going to do a more of like an EDC type thing or with a CHL or whatever, you know, I prefer a wheel gun. Because I want something I can hide, that's smaller, like a snub nose, that I can hide on me easily. And frankly, if I need more than six shots, I'm dead anyway. And the same types of guys will also say, but if I'm going out and training, I will want my pistol. And it's interesting, Fox, you should mention that if you're actually doing an actual carry, whether it's concealed or open, that you should always have extra ammo on you. In which case, if that is the best way to go, then it would make more sense to carry a pistol with spare mags, would it not? Versus a wheel gun with speed loaders?
Well, you can find concealed pouches for everything. You can go back and forth on philosophy of open versus concealed. But, like I said, you know, if you don't carry more than six rounds on you and people are counting on you to defend them, you're not taking it seriously. It's people underestimate how serious that is when you decide to become that sheepdog and carry your hand. You're not just defending yourself. You're defending the public. And if you take six rounds and that's it, you're not taking things seriously. More likely to carry mags over speed loaders, you can find comfortable, concealable things for anything. If you're better with a revolver and you carry a fully loaded revolver with three speed loaders in a pouch, do it to it. Whatever works for you. But you need to have more than six rounds.
Okay, definitely hear you loud and clear on that. I just wanted to address that because obviously if someone's going to be carrying a revolver, whether they're going out training or they're doing a concealed or open carry, if they're of the mind that, if it's a five or six round wheel gun and then like how I described earlier, and you know, if I need more than that, I'm dead anyway. If you're saying, and this, you've explicitly said this, that if that's a fallacious notion, then it would kind of make sense to have something where they can reload easily. And obviously, reloading a wheel gun with manually round by round is a pain. And besides, where would you store the extra bolts in a spare butt pocket? So that's why I brought up the speed loaders because that's the closest thing I can think of for a revolver, like how a magazine is to a pistol.
Yeah, you know, it's just practice. I know there's people who can speed reload handguns and speed reload revolvers just as fast as the other one. It's all personal, and you just need to take it into account what works for you and what you think you can employ in a defense situation of yourself or the public. If you can reload your revolver quicker than I can reload my handgun, I'll stand right next to you. That's fine. But don't go out. I've repeated myself a lot, but don't go out with six rounds because you're letting everybody down.
Okay, definitely hear you loud and clear on that. I just thought it was important to emphasize that because I've been hearing some weird kinds of things like I just brought to y'all's attention. So I thought that was important to address that, because I haven't heard anybody address that distinction before, so I'm glad you did. Moving onward to long guns, starting with bolt-action rifles. You know, so Rawls recommended a 22. One that I found was something called a Winchester Wildcat, which obviously the caliber is 22. Barrel is 21 inches. The weight is approximately between 4.5 to 5.5 pounds. And it has, supposedly it comes with like 1 5-round and 3 10-round detachable mags. And the price ranges from approximately $260 to $300.
Well, you know, I don't want to get shot with a 22. You know, it's a formidable weapon. If you can hit somebody with a 22, it's going to bounce around and do a lot more damage than you can see. As far as the survivalist standpoint, small game, target practice for the young ones, there's a number of great uses for a 22, and I cannot argue with his recommendations on anything, especially the 22. It's a really good round to have. Plus, really inexpensive to stock up and maintain.
Okay. Now, another one of his recommendations was the bolt-action rifle in a 308 or 30-06. Now, just to be clear, would it be accurate to say that the caliber of 7.62 millimeter is approximately equivalent to a 308?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, going with that, something I found. Now Rawls said bolt action. Now I'm going to kind of modify this a bit, but something I found, which is technically more of a semi-auto, was something that was a Century Arms Centurion Sporter CMTE, GP, and AK models, and really more the Kalashnikov model. Caliber is, of course, 7.62 millimeter. Weight is 7.5 to approximately 9 pounds. Wooden stock, and has a 20 to 30 round magazine. Going prices ranges between $200 and $800.
I get what you pay for.
So, I mean, do you think that's a little, and I'm kind of bringing these up as examples just for brand new guys, they can kind of get an idea for, you know, what's kind of good, because obviously you don't want to go so cheap, because sometimes you'll get something subpar that's a piece of junk. So for a semi-auto rifle chambered in a 7.62 or slash 308 is a price that's approximately $200 to $800. Does that sound about right, or is that lowballing, or what are your thoughts on that?
That sounds about right for Century. When you said 7.62, there's 7.62 by 39, which is the Russian surplus for the AK-47 platforms and SKS. And then there's 7.62 by 5.4, which is the Russian surplus, which is closest to the 308, which is 7.62 by 5.1. The 308 and the AK round are, there's a big difference there. You know, I'm not saying AKs are bad. A lot of people have, you know, their own personal preference towards AKs, and that's great. Love AKs. But the round is big. It's not as accurate. The 308 and the 7.62 by 5.4 are extremely accurate. 30-06, extremely accurate, but you're looking at a bigger price.
When you say bigger price, are we talking about in terms of the firearm and the ammunition, or just one or the other, or just more precisely?
Both in some cases. You can find a cheap 308 rifle, but the 308 round itself is pretty expensive.
Okay. And finally, going to addressing Rawls's recommendation on a 12-gauge, I actually found a couple, but I'll just pick one for the purpose of this particular broadcast. Something called Mitchell's Escalade. It's a 12-gauge. Weight is basically 5 pounds for all intents and purposes. You can either get it in a walnut or composite stock. Hell, I get it in walnut personally. It's got a 7-round capacity, and the price is approximately $300.
For what was that?
This was for a 12-gauge shotgun by Mitchell's Escalade, 7-round capacity. You can get the stock in walnut or composite. The price is approximately $300.
That sounds about right for a shotgun.
Okay.
You know, I personally, I'm partial to Mossberg, and that's simply because of the ergonomics and how it fits me, with the slide release being closest to my middle finger. Where the safe, you know, it's a wonderful shotgun is the Mossberg. The 590A1 went through the military testing and whatnot and did all that stuff, so you know you're getting a good shotgun, but you're looking at paying about $500.
Oh, geez, okay.
But yeah. You get what you pay for. You know, it's a Mossberg. You're not going to regret a single penny going towards that.
Even if it does cost a little bit more?
If, especially for a Mossberg, costs $200 extra, that's a couple more missed meals for you, but you're not going to regret it.
Okay, well, definitely going to keep that in mind. Now, as kind of a follow-up on that, do you think it's better, or what are your thoughts in general on, like, a pistol grip for shotguns? Good, bad, indifferent, your thoughts?
It's all personal, you know. I personally don't really like the pistol grip on a Mossberg because of where the slide release is. It makes it difficult to reach. Some people love it. Some people can get to that slide release, no problem. It's all personal. There's nothing wrong at all with having a pistol grip on there. Some people it might impede if you use that shotgun for procuring game and bird. Other people are lights out with a pistol grip on a hunting gun. I mean, no problems with it. No problems without it. I personally don't have it on any of my shotguns. It's all personal. I can't stress that enough. You know, you can't take my word for exactly what's going to work for you. You need to understand that everything is personal. What works for me probably won't work for you. What works for you probably won't work for me.
Okay, and as we start to close out for tonight, I did want to address, how can people go about just buying guns? I mean, especially for new shooters, how do you, if you had to explain to somebody right now, especially somebody who's just clueless and doesn't know any better but is interested in becoming a gun owner, how do they get started buying guns?
Well, there's gun shops everywhere, even in Chicago. Go to a gun shop, talk to the people behind the counter. They know exactly what they're talking about. But keep in mind, they are salesmen. They will never talk down about a gun. So keep that in mind. They're just trying to get that commission for the most part. They will give you good recommendations, but they will never speak poorly about a handgun or any firearm. You can go to a gun shop. You can go to any of these websites on the internet. Just be careful with what you're doing on the internet with firearms. There's many resources I would suggest starting at a gun shop. They're everywhere. This is America, man.
I hope so. Okay, well, let's kind of look at that a little bit more. Like, okay, so Fox, what's the difference between a gun store and a gun show?
With most of the stands or tables at a gun show, you're still going to have to talk to people. There's a lot of private sellers, and in most states don't require paperwork or anything like that. You just fork over the cash, he'll fork over the rifle or shotgun, and game over. You know, that's it. It's yours. Just make sure you understand your local laws and regulations. You know, you don't want to get pinched for something stupid. All you're trying to do is buy a gun. A lot of places in gun shows, I've noticed, if you have your CCL, they'll just sell it to you without doing background checks or anything like that. You know, there's the only difference between a gun show and a gun shop is the private sellers walking around. That's about it.
Right, and, you know, obviously there are people that are concerned about their privacy, and frankly, I don't blame them, because, you know, if you go around and buy, like, something else, you buy pens, pencils, pieces of paper, anything else, you know, even knives a lot of times, you don't have to fill out paperwork and put down the serial number and the or get a background check, even if you're buying a knife a lot of times. And that sort of thing. But for some strange reason, with the invention of the firearm, they now require that. It's really kind of bizarre.
Well, you need, you know, all these ridiculous things in England now. Look at what they're doing with knives and self-defense in England, and the British can't defend themselves because they handed over the guns. So, you know, when you're going to a gun show with the intent to buy a gun, make sure you understand your local laws and regulations on private sales and things like that, if that's the route you decide to choose. Otherwise, happy hunting. Go get a gun and get some ammo and enjoy the freedom. I mean, it's such an awesome feeling in the grander scheme of things that we as Americans are allowed the freedom of a firearm. It's unspeakable, because a lot of countries just simply don't allow it, and we need to understand that if a right unexercised is a right lost. So, you know, get out there and get some guns and train up and train up right. You know, amateurs train until they get it right. Professionals train until they can't get it wrong. You need to get out there, and you need to practice, and you need to do all these things to understand that it's a responsibility to be a gun owner. You know, you're responsible for defending yourself, your family, your community, and it's so important and such an amazing freedom that we have now. So get out there, people. Get it done.
Now, that's on the more privacy and liberty side of it. Now, let's look at money briefly. Now, obviously, with some of those prices I was quoting earlier, we're talking about a couple hundred dollars here, a couple hundred dollars there. I know there are some AR platforms, depending on you know, how many doodads, because I think one of the problems with the AR platform, at least as far as the firearms industry treats it, is that they tend to, how shall we say, accessorize the hell out of the AR platform. I've seen some run up easily $2,000 without trying.
Oh, yeah.
So, in terms of money, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this, Fox. I mean, at what point, especially if you're on a budget of some kind, I mean, how do you – now, obviously, if money's no object, then that's a different issue. But for those where it is a problem, but they still want to engage in gun ownership, and preferably gun use is kind of the important part. But in order to get the tools, how far do you push trying to drive that monetary amount down without sacrificing quality? How do you do that balancing at that tightrope walking of trying to get the best quality firearm you can for the least amount of money?
You just gotta do your hunting. You know, you gotta go out and you gotta find specials. You gotta find a lot of gun stores I've seen do what's called gun show specials, where they'll knock a couple hundred dollars off for something here or there. You know, if you're on a budget, skip a couple meals, if you know, unless you have a family. Do what you have to do, but don't go out and buy garbage equipment, because it's going to fail. You're going to spend a couple extra $100, you're going to spend some extra money here and there, and you're going to have to sacrifice a little bit, but you know, it's something that you're going to have to do. You don't want to buy poor equipment and just blame it on the economy or something. You know, it's so important that people don't go out and buy $50 optics because they don't want to pay for an EOTech. Well, you have a $50 optic, but it's garbage. It looks cool. Looks cool as hell. But it's not going to help you. It's going to break. Battery's going to run out because it's garbage. A lot of these EOTech and Aimpoint clones that they have out there are not holographic sights. With the holographic sight, with the EOTech Aimpoint, if your face is off the gun or you're, you know, not in that ideal perfect shooting position on your firearm, you will be 100% right on there on the red dot. With these clones, it's just a little red dot projected on the screen, which if your face is not on there, if you're in a stressed position and you're not in that ideal shooting stance, your shots are going to be off. So yeah, you got something that looks cool, looks like an EOTech or Aimpoint, but if you're not lined up exactly perfect 100% of the time, you're missing your shots and you're failing and you're letting everybody down. So yeah, you gotta hunt around, you gotta make some sacrifices, you gotta miss a few meals. Do what you have to do. You need to get quality equipment. And, you know, the last thing I'm gonna say on this, I'm gonna go off a little bit on a tangent here. If you are not proficient 150% with your iron sights, do not put optics on there. If you put optics on a AR-15 and you practice and your lights out, you're awesome, you're a great shot, you're one MOA at 250 yards shooting the top off a Tabasco bottle with that optic on there, the second that optic gets fragged, runs out of batteries, cracks, anything happens to it, you're down to your iron sights, and if you're not 100% on, you're SOL. So that's all I'm going to say about that. You got to make the sacrifice if you really want it.
Wow, and very good advice about when you're doing your marksmanship, especially for the new shooters, because, well, this particular podcast is designed especially with new shooters in mind, that, got to get good with those iron sights. I mean, I remember during my days, my Boy Scout days, when I earned rifle shooting merit badge, I mean, we didn't use scopes at any point. We were engaging targets, you know, 25, 30, 35 yards, roughly, different ranges like that. It wasn't that much. With 22s at a bench rest, and we all did it through iron sights. We did not use optics or anything like that. And for the most part, pretty much everybody passed and got their merit badge. And we were able to shoot like 5-shot groups pretty tightly. Where I think the standard was taking a quarter and putting it on the paper target and seeing if all the holes could be touched by that quarter. So that kind of gives you an idea with that range and with the sizing of how tight the grouping needed to be. And we were able to do that with iron sights. Everybody was.
Anybody can. It's the basics you need to understand. Breathing, control, trigger control. I mean, it's all the same stuff. Anybody can do it. It's just a firm understanding of the basics. And congratulations. If you're shooting quarters at 35 yards, good stuff, man.
Right, of course. Now, something else I didn't want to address before we end for tonight is, and again, this is something that newer shooters need to be aware of. Now, for some people, it's going to be very, very, very relevant. For others, not so much. But I think it does need to be addressed at the very least, is a term that I believe Colonel Cooper, Jeff Cooper, used, which was hoplophobia, basically an irrational fear of guns. So, Fox, what can be done to at least address those individuals, especially those who tend to be family members or relatives of people who are not paranoid about the existence of the invention known as the firearm? What can be done, especially in terms of dealing with folks who unfortunately have hoplophobia and irrational fear of guns?
Well, Yeah, I mean, you're talking about sitting down and explaining, or, you know, sit down in front of them and put your gun on the table and say, look, it's not doing anything. It's the person behind the gun. I can kill you with a hammer. Do you have an irrational fear of hammers? You know, you don't see legislation being pushed forward to regulate the sale of cars and background checks. Some of these people who have licenses should not have licenses. Cars kill way more people than guns do. Granted, it's horrific, the numbers of people killed by guns, but this irrational fear is unbelievable. So, you know, just sit down and explain to them, here's my gun, nobody's getting hurt by it. It's only when the person behind it. Exactly. Guns are just metal until you put it in the hand. And if you put it in the wrong person's hand, then it becomes dangerous. If the wrong person gets behind the wheel of the car, it becomes dangerous. If the baseball bat ends up in Robert De Niro's hand, it becomes dangerous. It's just a tool. And when the tool is in the right person's hand, then things are things are balanced. The moral majority of gun owners are just like you and me. I don't know if you're a gun owner. The moral majority of gun owners are all the same. They're out here, they're free and independent, and they're gun owners for hunting, they're gun owners for sport, they're gun owners for self-defense. And they're all the same. They're not going to ever do anything bad with those guns. It's that 1% of people who end up with a gun, because criminals are going to get guns anyways, that give us the bad name, and then the media blows it out of proportion. You know, you had said earlier, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, I came up with my own little phrase, guns don't kill people, gun control allows people to be killed.
That's very accurate.
You know, it's the moral majority of people, 99%. You know what? In this situation, I am okay with saying I am the 99% of gun owners who are with their firearms. 85 million guns killed nobody yesterday. It's a extremely blown out of proportion statistic. Granted, it's horrific, and I hate seeing it, but it's not something that people need to have this horrific fear of, because cars kill more people than guns do.
Right, and I just posted a link to both chat rooms, and for the guys listening later on the podcast version, there's a very good article over at Survival Blog that is entitled, and just type this into a search engine and play with it a little bit until you can find it, but the title of the article is A Woman's Journey Towards Firearms Acceptance. That is A Woman's Journey Towards Firearms Acceptance, which is over at survivalblog.com. And, you know, she even says in one of the sentences at the very beginning, I blithely lived out 51 years of life with a gun phobia. And then she goes on to describe how she basically suffered from basically haplophobia and how she went about overcoming that. And then she eventually says later that my gun phobia is all but gone. So there's at least one woman, and it's not always women, it's, you know, men too. But there's an example of this particular individual that actually got over haplophobia.
Well, that's good. You know, it's like I said, it's media bias, and I think the reason for it being blown out of proportion is it's easier to pacify a country whose citizenry can't shoot back. You know, for example, Australia, England, these places where there are horrific gun restrictions. You know, you see the government run rampant. And this is going back to the spirit of things, but That's the whole reason why we have the second article to the Bill of Rights. So our government does not run rampant upon us, so that we are in charge and they fear us. And, you know, it's just as simple as that. People can make their argument about the National Guard. People can make their arguments about whatever. It's, you know, that's what it's about. It wasn't put in there to protect hunters. It wasn't put in there so that clay shooters could go out every Sunday and shoot skeet and trap. It's put in there so that we're protected. Plain and simple.
Okay, now, as we are wrapping up this particular episode, Fox, are there any books or any other resources that you would suggest listeners and especially new shooters to consult so they can further their education about firearms beyond this particular podcast?
A lot of gun stores, well, the bigger gun stores, will offer safety classes. You can look at the NRA's website and look for an NRA trainer, safety trainer, whatever, in your area. They have them everywhere, and it's a great resource, especially for new shooters. I would say the same for any of you people living in shall issue states. You don't have to go through the classes to get your CCL. Take one of the NRA safety courses. They'll tell you the laws. They'll instruct you on how to shoot properly and how to, you know, do everything right. I think that's a great resource, and they're easy to find. There's the NRA certified trainers. Also, you know, we need to look to friends and family. You know, my grandpa, it's his fault. You know, it's his fault that I'm so adamant about my freedom, firearms ownership, and, you know, look to people who know what they're talking about. Other than that, books, I can't really think of anything offhand to recommend about new shooters. Yeah, I can't think of anything, but the NRA trainers, definitely, they're easy to find and they're everywhere.
Okay, just some things that I had is that there are a few websites that I found that were good. Obviously, there is the InternetArmory.com, EveryCitizenASoldier.org, and, of course, SurvivalBlog.com. A few books that some of them I've read, other ones have been recommended to me by folks who have a level head on their shoulders. Boston Tea Party's Boston's Gun Bible, Mel Tappan's Survival Guns, Kyle Lamb's Green Eye and Black Rifles, The Warrior's Guide to the Combat Carbine, Masad Ayoub's, fantastic writer, by the way, Masad Ayoub's The Gun Digest Book of Combat Handgunnery, Tiger McKee's Book of Two Guns, and another one that I'll put into the chats, that I've actually got sitting right here, is The Ultimate Guide U.S. Army Combat Skills, Tactics, and Techniques. And for the purposes of, like, basic firearms know-how, I would especially recommend under Part 2, Combat Weapons, under the Army Combat Rifle, Chapters 1, 2, and 3, which have to deal with an introduction to the M16. Chapter 2 is on Operation and Function, and then Chapter 3, which is especially important, is on rifle marksmanship training, and they go in a lot more detail about shooting positions and different drills you can do and stuff like that. Also, under that same part of combat weapons, if you go down a little bit more in the book, when they cover the Army combat pistol, which I believe they are using the M9 and the M11, chapters 1 and 2, components and functioning, followed then by pistol marksmanship training. Terrific stuff, and, you know, things I've never actually seen anywhere. Some of it's basic, some of it can get a little bit advanced, but I still think it's very much of a good read to at least give people the idea that when you get started learning how to use firearms, you can really, you know, get started and really kind of get good at it, especially if you know what you're doing. And yes, absolutely, if you can all afford it, try and take some NRA courses or other types of basic and even advanced hand, gun courses with rifles, shotguns, and pistols are usually the three main ones.
Yeah, just one thing before, you know, before you go out and buy these books and you go out to Top Shot in Nevada or any of these advanced carbine Thunder Ranch or anything like that, make sure that you understand the basics first. You need to walk or you need to crawl before you can walk. It's cool and it's sexy to run around and clear houses and you know, do all these running guns and stuff, but if you're not in full understanding of the basics and they are not drilled into your brain, you're going to hurt yourself or somebody else, or you're going to destroy any hopes of being able to successfully use your firearm in any situation. That goes for hunting, sport shooting, self-defense, anything. If you do not have the basics, if you have you bought your guns 2 weeks ago and then you sign up for a week at Thunder Ranch, you're putting people in danger. That's some advanced stuff, and they will show you stuff, I'm sure, but you are putting people in danger if you don't have the basics and you try to do advanced. All this stuff is great resources, by the way. Army training, all those other ones you listed, the tactical stuff, that's cool, it's sexy, it looks cool, makes you feel good about yourself, but if you don't understand the basics, it's a waste of your time and money.
Amen, and definitely with the new shooters, I was just definitely basic marksmanship, stuff you would do at a range. You know, you're not moving from position to position, doing anything like that. That comes later. For the purposes of just starting out, just basic gun range, can you handle recoil? Can you, like, hit anything? Just basic marksmanship. And, you know, those things I mentioned do address it, especially the Ultimate Guide to U.S. Army Combat Skills, Tactics, and Techniques, because they even mention the basics in there. And there's also a bunch of other things. You don't even need to buy that book. Again, those different websites I mentioned earlier, some of them at least will cover some of the basics. Then you can get started. I mean, you don't really need to buy much of anything. I mean, if you're really hard up on a budget, probably the best thing to do, especially considering that ammunition sales, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't like ammunition is like really, really costly now, breaking records?
Yeah, but that's due to supply and demand. You know, you can get 9mm for very cheap, very inexpensive. Just be careful with what you get. Don't go out with don't go out with steel cased rounds for a American made firearm. You know, just do your research. Don't use the wrong ammo, and you know, you get what you pay for. Like I said before, you're going to have to make sacrifices. If you take this seriously, you'll get it done. If you're not taking it seriously, you just want a gun because you think it's cool, you'll find an excuse. And that's, that's just how it goes.
All right. Well, I would like to thank you, Fox, for coming on tonight. I really do appreciate it.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
No problem. All right, folks, that will pretty much wrap it up for tonight. And it was actually brought to my attention earlier that I misspoke when I originally opened up tonight's podcast. Today is Monday, April 23rd of 2012. So sorry for the confusion. All right, so for next week's episode, or actually should be this upcoming week's episode on Saturday, April 28th, we will take a look at monarchism. I'm Sleepy Salsa, and thanks for listening.